Tom Gimbel, who, of course, joins us, oh, I think most weeks, Tom Gimbel from LaSalle Network. How's everything going, bud?
It's going great, John. I figured we're not going to talk Blackhawks all day today.
No. Now that the season's over, you know, we'll put that to bed for a little bit, although we're excited about the future, of course, here at WGN Radio with the Blackhawks, too. Don't get me started, Tom, because I could.
I know where your heart lies, John Hanson. I know where your heart lies.
Exactly. Hey, you sent over an interesting story. We love naming things, don't we? First, it was quiet quitting, and now something similar, a trend of resenteeism. I think I'm saying that right. Basically, working on autopilot, right, Tom?
Yeah, I think that's really what the text is, the context of it is I resent having to work hard because I don't like my job, so I'm just going to mail it in and show up, especially if you're making me come into the office. And, you know, I think a lot of the stuff is clickbait, John, as you and I have talked about before. But it gets people going. And listen, as long as there's been jobs, there's been people who've mailed it in.
Right.
And the difference between that and today is with social media, people create momentum around that, and they make the people that are actually the hard chargers who want to advance, like they're the outliers. And I think it's actually the opposite. I think the majority of people, they want to do good work. They want to work hard. They just want to be rewarded for it, which makes sense.
Right. I agree. There have always been people that are on autopilot at work since the beginning of work existing as a thing. And I don't think like a hard worker sees that trend and then adopts it, right? I think there is just a difference in the people who are wired to want to do well, not only to rise the corporate ladder, but just that's how they operate. That's their MO. I don't think that they would ever change, right?
No, I agree with you. I worked with a young guy. This is years ago. He's actually ended up starting his own company and became a client, but he worked for me years ago. And he was an accountant, and he wasn't really that good of an accountant. But I said to him one day, I said, you know what I really admire about you? And we had one-on-one talks about his the results and what he was good at and not. And I said, you do work really hard. You try really hard to get it right, and even though it's not always right. And he said, if I have to come to work every day, why wouldn't I try as hard as I can?
Yeah.
And I think that mentality exists with a lot of people. And what people need is feedback in order to pivot to make sure that the hard work is going in. Digging a great ditch in the wrong place is not a good job.
Right. Well said.
Yeah. You don't get rewarded for that. So, but being told that you're digging the ditch in the wrong place, somebody needs that feedback. And then go build the perfect ditch in the right place. And whether you're an accountant, a salesperson, a radio host, a CEO, is you need people to give you feedback on what you're doing well and what you're doing wrong, and then acknowledge when you achieve the next milestone of achievement, whether it's a ratings book or revenue or cost savings. And that's what people want. And I just think, to our point earlier, there's always going to be people who mail it in. And the key is, can companies identify who those people are, and are they going to exit them because they're demotivators for the others?
I'm very lucky to be flattered often by people saying that I'm one of the harder working people just because I show up a lot here on the radio station and the Hawks games and podcasting and stuff too. And I don't often admit this because I've always kind of had that since I moved back to Chicago to be in this industry. But Tom, I have to admit that until I got real humbled once, when I tried to pivot my career in Washington, D.C., and I was just bad at it, I don't think I had that in me. I think there is a little bit about that just because not everyone's born with that, Tom. I think sometimes you do have to be humbled to embrace what really works to get ahead. Would you agree?
There's no doubt about it. I've said this numerous times that just in my own experience, there's people that we've fired who have gone on to be successful someplace else.
Yes.
And had people in the company say, see, we should have held on to them. I go, no. They wouldn't have been successful here. The reason they're successful someplace else is because they got humbled. They weren't doing the work well here. And we tried to get them there. We tried, but they needed to be exited. And whether it's getting fired, whether it's getting a stern talking to, whether it's quitting because it didn't work and then you can't find a job, that level of humility, that being humbled to think that you're not beyond reproach, sometimes that's what we need. The same thing of the, you know, we're not all Michael Jordan, but the Michael Jordan getting cut from the varsity and having to play JV was the driver that got him to the next level. And yeah. It happens that way for all of us.
I agree. And I think that that message is, you know, for parents and grandparents who maybe their 20-year-olds, kids or grandkids or nieces and nephews are struggling in those early 20s, that's okay. You don't have to helicopter over them. They can make those mistakes. They can learn from them and they can move on. It's not like hope is lost if your 23-year-old isn't great at work yet. I'm not saying they necessarily will be at some point, but sometimes that humbling experience of getting fired, like you said, Tom, is that catalyst. Hey, we got to leave it there, Tom, as always. I love chatting with you. We'll do it again soon, okay?
Yep. Hopefully the Hawks will be great next year. Let's cheer for them.
They will, Tom Gimbel, LaSalle Network. Everything's great. I hope all is well with you, okay?
Take care, my friend.
Okay, let's pivot over. We're going to keep it in the workplace, talk a little gossip and how that's no good for a workplace. That's no big secret, Philip Weiss from SciFarth at Work. Philip, it's probably a perennial problem. Is it getting worse nowadays?
It is getting worse. It's one of these byproducts of the return to work and masks at so many offices. Employees had to acclimate to all kinds of stuff, in-person meetings, sometimes the manager hovering over them, things they did not deal with in the midst of COVID. And now, unexpectedly, a lot of the old traditions are coming back that define the in-person experience. And one of those is a rampant office gossip. We've gotten a number of calls over the last several weeks from business owners, human resources managers, telling us they should have been thinking about this, but the chatter around the workplace and the gossip mill is this unplanned for and often distressing reality now that people are back at work together.
So what's really the harm, though? I mean, I know it's not good, but why is it bad for business?
Yeah, it's a really great question, because at a certain level, to your point, having a friendly, shared moment is a good morale booster. The problem is, of course, that if it begins to spiral out of control or go in the wrong direction, you end up with all kinds of really damaging results. Productivity can drop when gossip sort of becomes the primary focus. It can be a real morale killer in some cases, particularly when colleagues are gossiping about each other negatively and forming almost a clique-like. And when it's a lack of information that should be shared from the top, and that information vacuum gets filled by people sharing info together, you can really have some issues that affect legitimacy and your own goals for the organization. So it's a legal issue. It's a interpersonal issue, and it's also a business objective issue as well.
You mentioned that vacuum of information. Yeah, sometimes the gossip is not personal stuff about your coworkers. I mean, it can be, but it's about, ooh, what's happening here? I heard this, that, or the other thing. Do companies need to fill that vacuum, even if there is no news to share, just to keep people updated so they feel like they're in the know, so they don't feel the need to start talking about nonsense?
Yeah, that's a hugely insightful question. And the reason why is, as you said, we might think if we run a business or run a department that there's nothing new going on. But let's not forget, employees are still adjusting to practices that they had not necessarily dealt with or encountered while they were working primarily or entirely remotely. So for them, anything they're experiencing that is new is new news to them. And certainly, if you are actually making changes, if you are going to be involved in some kind of leadership shakeup, a merger, an acquisition, rolling out new products or services, as soon as you can safely and legally share the plan with your employees, the better. And to your point, even if there's nothing to share in the immediate aftermath, still check in. Still let people know what the next thing is expected. Because if they don't hear anything, they will come up with their own facts. And in one case, we had a client that came to us. It was an East Coast shipping company. And gossip circulated because there had been a management upheaval moment. And everyone figured, look, if leaders at the top are leaving, they're probably going to start cutting the rest of us sooner or later. And some key mid-level managers left because they just didn't feel the security of knowing what was coming next. It would be simply remedied by letting people know this has been resolved, our plans are still in place, our objectives remain the same, and you are a valued employee or manager.
Chatting with Philip Weiss, president of SciFarth at Work. I imagine that if you're a company where you are directly involved with clients in some way, in a sales capacity or, you know, business to business, whatever the case may be, that leakage of the gossip to clients can really impact bottom lines if it's unsavory information, perhaps.
Yeah, that's so important. I mean, reputation becomes the sort of unforeseen casualty of internal gossip. And we helped a company, it was a Chicago-based consulting firm that dealt with this kind of issue you're describing, where there was a salesperson who the gossip mill indicated was engaging in some unscrupulous or unethical actions to secure deals. He was the number one guy on the sales team. And unfortunately, those stories, those allegations, that gossip, as you said, seeped out, leaked out. Other clients heard about it, and they just felt like it's not worth dealing with this company if they have that sort of reputation. It turned out, looking back, it was actually the number three salesperson on the same sales team that conjured up these stories because this was a little bit resentful of the number one person's success, not even thinking it would ever leave or exit the orbit of the sales team, let alone the whole company. So if you're hearing about issues, don't think they'll stay put. Nothing stays in Vegas when it comes to reputation or gossip.
Yeah, I'm sure you're sick of examples from The Office being quoted to you, but I suppose we shouldn't do the Michael Scott when he accidentally started a rumor and gossip. Then his idea was just to flood the zone with as much gossip as possible so people wouldn't know what to believe. Not the right approach, just to, you know, correct the gossip that is incorrect out there. Philip Weiss, Seyfarth at Work, seyfarthatwork.com, S-E-Y-F-A-R-T-H at work.com. Good to chat with you again, my friend.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me again.
We'll do it soon. Jason Turner joins us now, Chief Investment Strategist for Wintrust Wealth Management. Jason, it's good to meet with you and chat with you on the show. How are you doing?
Doing all right. Nice to be with you, John.
I think we're all feeling a little bit better here with the markets today and yesterday. I know it's impossible whether to tell this is a reversion to the bull market or just a buying opportunity for some people. I won't ask you to pick a side, but people sure are wondering where we're going next, aren't they?
Certainly. We've seen a strong start to the year in the first quarter. We've seen a bit of a correction, a stabilization, a pullback, whatever you may want to call it, early in April here. And now the last couple of days, we've gotten a little bit of a change in direction. And some of that has to do with what earnings are coming up on deck. And people may be a little excited about some of the NASDAQ names that will start announcing earnings here this week.
Yeah, so much attention has been paid to, well, what is the Fed going to do? And that's going to kind of guide where the markets go. The optimism of the Fed lowering the rates five or six times, as some people thought at the end of 2023, led a big rally. We have seen a pullback, but going from six potential rate cuts to one or two, if any, hasn't seen that reciprocal send back of the markets down. And I think you just touched on it. I mean, there are other things that go into the market than just whether the Fed is going to cut rates. And earnings are a huge part of it, right, Jason? I mean, really, that's kind of the basis of what the market's all about.
I think they certainly are. The Fed and what they do and what happens in the broader economy is always going to have some influence on what's going on in the stock market. But if we enter into time periods like we have seen to the start of this year, where individual company performance and results matter, you've seen it even within the Magnificent Seven with, example, Tesla struggling and NVIDIA flying early this year, that those individual company financials and earnings actually matter. And that's where the stock market can see better performance than what you would think based on what's happening in the economy or with Fed policy.
You mentioned some of those companies. I thought it was interesting seeing on Friday that 60% of the S&P 500 companies were winners, yet we had a losing day on the market. And it's because of some of those bigger companies maybe coming off a little bit of their highs. Does that speak to the idea, Jason, that people just need to make sure that their portfolios are somewhat balanced? Is that maybe the next wave of things, seeing these companies that have maybe been undervalued stepping up to the plate a little bit here?
Absolutely. We've been strong proponents, particularly within the multi-asset team that I had here at Wintrust and Great Lakes, that that value of diversification plays out over the long term. So while you might be a big winner in a short term, going with one of those high-flying stocks that has been really running from a performance perspective, when the market broadens its focus, as you mentioned, it has recently, and those other companies start being rewarded or other segments of the market, you want to make sure you're there and you have that diversified footprint so that over the long term, your results are what you expect or better.
Okay, so let's talk to the average investor, people that listen to this program, maybe don't know every ETF stock's ticker symbol. Not asking you to give specific advice, but just generally speaking, how does one find if they are maybe more balanced? How do you look under the hood at a 401k or your brokerage account to go, oh, this might be a little bit off? Are there certain key indicators that someone might be able to see?
A couple key ways to see if you've got a diversified portfolio or not. First, you're going to look on the size of the companies you're invested in. If you own broadly diversified funds in a 401k or retirement account, if they are all owning large U.S. companies, you have a concentration there in large U.S. companies. You want to own some smaller size companies. I mentioned it there with U.S. too. Geographic diversification helps. We have seen, for example, a very strong market in Japan over the last year or so. For U.S.-centric investors, you kind of missed that performance. That market has actually beaten the U.S. market on a local currency basis over the last year. So we look at regions, we look at size of the company, and then you look at sector diversification. Do the funds you own, and you can look this up on just about any website, whether it's Yahoo Finance or Morningstar, look up the sector diversification of those funds and see, do I just own a whole bunch of energy companies? And if so, your portfolio will rise and fall in the futures of oil. But if it's well diversified, like a S&P 500 index fund, you'll see representation from all 11 or 12 economic sectors across the economy.
I so advocate people looking under the hood, even if they are starting from scratch and they look under the hood and they don't get what they're looking at. Number one, they can contact people like you and the folks at Wintrust Wealth, of course. But just start looking, start Googling, start arming yourself with that information about what's in your retirement account. Yes, if you touch everything too much, you might mess it up a little bit, but it's more like, at first, knowledge is power. And I think everyone needs to do that, even if they are a passive investor in their retirement accounts.
Absolutely. And if you want trusted advice and ask a trusted advisor for their take, if you want to do a little research on your own, there's some great tools out there, free tools out there online that you can access that can help you become a little bit more informed about what you're investing in.
For sure. All right, Jason, we're just getting started. You'll hang on after the break. I want to talk to you about some breaking financial news about what the Labor Department has decided to do in terms of people getting bad retirement savings advice. We'll tackle that in a moment. Jason Turner, continuing our conversation with the Chief Investment Strategist for Wintrust Wealth Management. Good timing, Jason. We got the breaking news today from the Labor Department. And they're cracking down on bad retirement savings advice. I've read the article. I'm reading a couple times now. I'm trying to figure out exactly what's changed here. Have you had a chance to read up on this?
I've had a chance to look at it briefly, not read through the entirety of the rule. But the basic gist here is that the Department of Labor, which will oversee retirement plans and retirement investments by individuals through an IRA, used to define the role of a advisor in one way, and now they are clarifying that to meet what is called a fiduciary standard. In effect, an advisor to an individual saving for retirement will be required to give advice that puts the client first, as opposed to being potentially in a sales situation where someone could try to sell a product to an individual in a retirement account that might make the person brokering or selling that investment more money and not have greater benefit to the client commensurate with that higher fee.
We've always told people, like, ask advisors, no matter who you're talking with, one of our fine partners that are on this radio station or otherwise, are you a fiduciary? And to make sure that as best you can that they are. Does that take the need for that out of the equation by requiring people to be fiduciaries to give advice, or is this more suggestive, or should people still do their own homework?
Well, people should always do their own homework. Always ask your potential advisor in what capacity they are going to help you, and you want to hear that fiduciary response from them, particularly if it's a retirement account. If this is savings that you're going to rely on to facilitate your retirement years, You want to make sure it's there and you don't lose assets. The President's Council of Economic Advisors estimates that just in one type of product, a higher fee structure in a product that's typically sold as opposed to recommended in a fiduciary capacity costs the average American retirement saver in aggregate $5 billion a year in additional fees. So this is no small sum of money we're talking about when we look at the aggregate.
Interesting. Yeah, and when you're talking about selling things, like the words annuities come to mind, things like that, people that are saying, hey, roll over your retirement into this. Not saying that those products aren't useful as part of a retirement, but I guess it's still the person has to be putting the client in the best interest, right? You can't just charge or make them go into a different account because the fees are higher, right? You got to have some justification about how it ends up being better for the client, if I am understanding that correctly.
Absolutely right. Americans rolled over in 2022 nearly $800 billion from 401k plans where there are fiduciaries and administrators choosing the funds for you in those plans to an individual retirement account, where now you're on your own, either managing it on an internet broker or more likely getting financial advice from someone. And in those rolled over IRAs, you need to be informed about the decisions you're making. There are a myriad of different financial products available to investors, and some may be appropriate for some individuals with their goals and risks in mind, and may not be appropriate for others. So having that conversation with somebody who is, in effect, sitting on the same side of the table as you, putting you first, is going to benefit individual investors going forward.
All right, we're going to get some more government data as the week progresses along, including GDP is going to come out on Thursday. We'll get some jobless claims, too. Manufacturing PMIs today came out a little less than expected. What are you looking for? What are your eyes looking at? Is it inflation again is the number that you're most keen to looking at right now?
It's no longer just inflation. Certainly keeping an eye on inflation, and I think you're seeing slightly different stories from CPI, which is the headline-grabbing number, and PCE, which is the Fed's preferred measure that we'll get later this month. But when we get that GDP result, it should tell us the story that the economy has slowed somewhat from its pace of last quarter. That slowing pace should only encourage inflation to slow down. The other areas I'm keeping a close eye on are employment markets. The unemployment rate remains very, very low in the 3% range, 3.8. The natural rate of unemployment, or what the Fed would call full employment, is somewhere in the 4% range. So employment markets remain out of balance from a supply and demand perspective. That adds fuel to the economy as more individuals are drawing paychecks. And consumer consumption, whether you want to measure that as retail sales or personal consumption expenditures, the American consumer has decided to shrug off any economist's idea of a recession over the last 18 months and just continues to spend money. Continues to grow retail sales. We saw an outsized growth in retail sales last month. Those are areas I continue to watch to see how hot the American economy remains or how deep a slowdown it might be headed for.
Yeah, when people ask me, when are we going to get back to normal on inflation? I say, well, of course, I don't know. I have no idea. But I say that the goal for all of us is that we aren't setting an alarm to the 7:30 Central Time announcement on Inflation Day. Like, once we stop doing that, because I set an alarm to make sure that I see it come in breaking, once a few of us start paying less attention to it, that would be indicative of a good sign, meaning that we just, not everything is so tied to that number. But for right now, I mean, that still is a number people are watching.
It absolutely is. And I think you can see in either the University of Michigan's Consumer Sentiment Index or the Conference Board's Confidence Index that we're at lower levels of consumer sentiment, which just doesn't fit with the amount of money American consumers are spending in the marketplace. And that observation is simply just they hear those high inflation numbers or higher than expected inflation numbers, and they think, oh, it's not so great.
Yeah.
But they're still spending money.
You know, it's interesting, Jason, you brought that up. We could do a whole show on the difference between the consumer sentiment number and what the pocketbooks are saying. I did read a really interesting piece that as people are polled now about sentiment, so often now everything is tied to politics, for better or for worse, probably for worse, just in general, right? Like, not everything is political, but people being asked about the consumer sentiment know that the pollster is really going to use that, or could be implied as a referendum on who's in the White House. And as people know that, they change their answer. I don't want to ask you to comment on that, Jason. That's a lava pit I just threw you in. But it is interesting, the gathering of this data, whether you're talking about jobs reports or consumer sentiment, how it's gathered and what people are saying, we do have to take a little scrutiny and look deeper at that.
We absolutely do. It's important to note that a lot of these economic data points that folks like me like to throw around, like the PMIs you mentioned earlier, are based on surveys or based on questions that are asked of business owners or of individual consumers. It's a sample. We have seen over the course of the last several years, whether it's Brexit or election results here in the United States or in other countries, that those surveys don't always get the end result right, and those surveys may not be painting an accurate picture of the economy in whole. And that's why I like to look at some of the harder data points, actual dollars spent in terms of consumption or the number of individuals on unemployment rolls. Those tend to paint at least a more accurate snapshot currently of what's going on in the economy.
All right. Jason Turner, it was a pleasure to chat with you. We appreciate your time, okay?
Nice to be with you, John. Thank you.
That's Jason Turner, Chief Investment Strategist for Wintrust Wealth Management. WintrustWealth.com.